it is very difficult for a driver as talented as George is and as motivated as he is to recognize he can't dictate the direction of the team and he can't automatically go against team orders.
The F1 season is coming thick and fast, and a week after Singapore, we're back to discuss an intriguing Japanese Grand Prix. In this week's show, we'll be covering Checo's rough and tumble with Lewis and how it impacted the seven-time world champion's race, all the discussion from Lewis and George's robust racing, and reveal some good news on future upgrades and 2025. So sit back and join me, Val Baines, on this episode of the Silver Arrows podcast as we discuss all the action on and off the track from Suzuka. And to help us do all of that, we have friend of the show and F1 tech expert, Bryson Sullivan. Hello, Bryson. It is so, so good to see you again.
It's good to see you guys too. It's been a little while since I've been on the podcast.
It has been a little while. We'll be talking about the Japanese Grand Prix. So as always, we'll go in chronological order. So we'll start with FP1 and FP2. So Mercedes bought upgrades, specifically their rear wing end plate.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure so much this was a proper upgrade per se, but something that I noticed about their rear wing is that you may have seen several teams in recent races cutting away some of the end plate transition, sort of a triangular shape. You know, Red Bull was the latest team to actually try this in Singapore. It's believed to help improve the high-speed performance of the car, high downforce configuration, reduce the induced drag a little bit. There's also some thoughts that it could improve downforce, but I'm not quite as convinced of that. What struck me about Mercedes's design is that instead of having a completely different wing, one with a cutout and one without a cutout, they actually had a modular interface there where they could sort of hot swap in versions of that end plate transition, one that was cut away and one that was actually a more traditional one. So I could do back-to-back comparisons for, you know, top speed, downforce and things like that without having to completely fit a new rear wing. Because as you know, rear wings are much more difficult to replace than front wings. If you get a front wing incident, you can, you know, replace them in the pits. If you have a rear wing problem, like Lance Stroll had this weekend, your race is over.
Yeah, and Mercedes were struggling as well in FP1 and FP2. Is there any reason why or how that happened?
Yeah, I mean, FP1 and FP2 really set the tone for the entire weekend, I would say. I think there's two main issues to think about with Mercedes, and one of them is just overall downforce level. It's not quite as high as some of the other top teams. They also had some really serious problems with tire preparation, just getting the tires in the right window at the start of the lap. They would have so much struggles in this first sector and then start to sort of become a bit more competitive in the second and third sectors. But they also seem to have a drag issue. And there's a little bit of subtlety here in Suzuka, because the location where the speed trap is for this track is actually not a location where the DRS is actually activated. Like the speed trap is 70 meters after 130R, and the DRS is only activated on the main straight. And so there's a little bit of nuance involved in differentiating a car with a high baseline level of drag versus a car that just doesn't have a very effective DRS. And even though Mercedes is reasonably competitive as far as baseline drag, you know, the drag, the top speed of the speed trap, they were quite far behind in the main straight. And the DRS was open. So they really weren't seeing the same effectiveness the other teams were seeing. And that's one of the areas where Red Bull is just, you know, still class leading in DRS effectiveness. And add to that, their highly competitive downforce levels. It made them very strong at this track.
Moving on to FP3 and quali, we have a question from Blue Dahlia. And they ask, please explain the shift in performance from Singapore to Japan, where Mercedes really look not competitive, especially in quali.
Yeah, this is one of the things that I find so interesting about Formula One. This idea that this team has a fast car and that team has a slow car is so varied because we race on so many different types of circuits. We race in the daytime, we race at night, we race on street tracks, we race on proper Grand Prix circuits. All of these things influence how well the car performs inherently. And then add on top of that, the team could just get it wrong. They could just get the setup wrong in that particular weekend. And in fact, getting a setup, you know, nailing a setup to be perfectly accurate for a given race weekend is worth more in real terms than an upgrade. It's entirely possible to put an upgrade on a car and have the wrong setup and go slower. I mean, Red Bull experienced that in Singapore when they were reverted to their earlier spec of floor. But the biggest things I would say, the difference between Singapore and Suzuka, even though both of those circuits are very high downforce circuits in general, Suzuka is much faster overall. The fast corners are faster at Suzuka. There are less hard braking zones. And the entire second half of the lap, essentially, is flat out. You know, 130R is flat out these days, and you know, you're braking for the final chicane, and then you're flat out again for the main straight. And there's a lot of straight line part of the racetrack, and that's an area where Mercedes really doesn't excel currently. There are other teams that have similar power units, you know, McLaren, for example, that are also, you know, are very competitive, but they're making up so much more time in the high-speed corners. And that's why, you know, McLaren is one of the teams that we really are going to have to look out for going forward. They're not just reasonably competitive at Monza and at Silverstone and Hungary and at other circuits. They're now competitive at Singapore and Suzuka, and they're building momentum in a way that really can't be ignored. So I think there's a discussion to be had, you know, towards the end of the season and going forward. Not only are we going to look at Mercedes adopting a Red Bull-esque, you know, design for the future, but look at what McLaren is doing. Maybe it's even time to look at a pull rod front suspension. You know, we ignored that question from McLaren for so many months, and suddenly at this point in the season, who are the top two teams in Formula One right now? It's McLaren and Red Bull, both share some interesting suspension choices. So certainly open for discussion.
Yeah, it definitely is. Lewis said in his post-race interview that Mercedes will have to have the biggest development ever in the next 6 months just to keep up with the guys at the front. So yeah, it's definitely a good.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Good point. So moving on to the race, Scuba on Twitter asked, how much damage, this was a massive talking point here, Bryson, how much damage did Lewis sustain in the clashes with Checo?
Turns out you can't go four wide into turn one at Suzuka. I never knew that. You know, obviously the damage with Lewis was directly with Checo, but I was watching that incident back and it was actually kicked off by Carlos Sainz. Carlos Sainz was the car immediately to Checo's right, and he, you know, made a jerk to the left. Checo maybe could have backed out of the situation, hit the brakes, but I'm not even sure that would have worked. He was so close to the other car, and Lewis was the one who felt the effect of that, you know, going into turn one. Lewis was, I want to say, three quarters of the way off the track I believe 3/4 of the width of his car was off the track. So for him to be able to maintain control of the car and actually stay almost in place, you know, got right behind Checo again going into the S's, that was an incredible piece of driving on his part. In terms of damage, my understanding is that there's at least a couple of points of loss and downforce either due to damage to the right wing end plate dive plane, and probably also a little bit of damage to the floor edge as well. So when you look back and considering how good of a race Lewis actually had, it could have been even better if some other changes were to happen later on. But he did all of that with a damaged car, which is a very impressive effort.
Do you think it was a racing incident then, Bryson? Or do you think, what were your thoughts on that sort of clash between Checo?
As I said, well, first of all, let's color this, our conversation, with the history of Checo's decision-making prior to and after this incident. Those were much more clearly his fault, either through driving mistakes or just arrogance, or the it didn't lead to a move that was successful in any definition of the word. But this specific one, this specific incident with Lewis at the beginning part of the lap, I will pass a little bit judgment on that, simply because it was Carlos Sainz who contacted Checo first, and immediately following that was the contact with Lewis.
Perfect. Awesome. Thank you so much for that, Bryson. So moving on to Anthony, how does Mercedes control George Russell? Every race, he is hijacking the strategy. I understand he has to do this because he is not as quick over a race distance, but it's constantly hampering Lewis and the team. This won't work in a title battle against Max and Red Bull.
You know, it's such an interesting situation that Mercedes finds itself in at the current moment in time. When George joined Mercedes, Toto told him specifically, he says, you know, I have good news and bad news. So the good news is you're going to race for Mercedes Formula One team, AMG Petronas Formula One team. The bad news is you're going to have to race against Lewis Hamilton. And in the early stages of that, in the early part of 2022, and even towards the middle parts of 2022, George was on an incredible run. He was finishing in the top five race after race after race, got a couple of podiums, was just enjoying life. Lewis was, you know, working heavily to improve the car and do some things to make the team as competitive as it could be, but it required some sacrifices. And not only that, I think we underestimate the psychological burden that Lewis Hamilton carried as a direct consequence of what was done to him in Abu Dhabi 2021. I think Lewis is an incredibly strong driver, and he is a very magnanimous figure. I can imagine other racers in the paddock who would burn the sport to the ground if what happened to them, if what happened to Lewis Hamilton had happened to them. But he decided to continue racing and to try to move forward, which is a very admirable thing to do. But I don't think we can ignore the effect that had on him and his ability to perform day in and day out in a car that was the worst car he had ever driven, that had a Mercedes badge on the side of it, compared to, you know, George Russell, who was used to driving atrocious cars. And by George's previous experience, the W13 was a fantastic car. And so you can imagine that there's sort of a discrepancy between the ultimate pace of both drivers. I believe George experienced a false impression of how good he actually was compared to Lewis. And again, George Russell is an extremely talented driver. He has been the number one driver in every team he's been a part of. He has to have that mentality to have reached the level that he has. And I think last year, the experience of last year and the overall way in which it unfolded gave him the impression that he can really be the number one driver in Mercedes. Lewis is on the way out and he's the new guy. But that's just not the reality of the situation. And I think 1 year on from 2022, we're starting to get a better impression of what Lewis is really like. He's not really, you know, 10 out of 10 Lewis quite yet. I'm sure he thinks he is, and, you know, he's driving incredibly well. But I think he can be even better. I think he can be even better. And so if you're asking how to control George, I think part of this is just the general realization that George isn't actually running Mercedes. George isn't actually the lead driver in Mercedes. And he could be if he were faster or made less mistakes. But at this moment in time, he's not. And it is very difficult for a driver, as talented as George is and as motivated as he is, to recognize he can't dictate the direction of the team and he can't automatically go against team orders. I mean, we've seen an emerging trend with George where he will either outright not follow team orders if it doesn't benefit him, or he will come up with an excuse to kick the can down the line and maybe follow orders some other time. And Mercedes is complicit to a degree in allowing that. They're starting to get more firm with him as time goes on, and they gave him a direct order, rumored to be from Toto Wolff himself in the hospital. We'll see. But I think this is just an overall process of both the team and the drivers understanding where they really are and where their respective levels are. I'm sure there's a question on the line, you know, is there a true number one driver at Mercedes? And historically speaking, that really hasn't been the case. It's been an opportunity to be able to fight on even terms. And whoever is in the championship by halfway or a few races from the end, they are the one that the team's going to back. It's just that all parties need to be on the same page, and they just aren't right now.
Yeah, it seems like they're all singing from different hymn sheets at the moment. And yeah, like you said, they need to be all on one page. Do you think George will become the number one driver in the 2 years that Lewis and George have signed their contracts up to the end of 2025?
I'm not really sure. I know that if I had a team that I wanted to win a constructors' championship in a year when two cars were very, very similar, I would absolutely want George on my team. George is an extremely fast driver. I mean, for comparison, look at Red Bull currently. Max is getting 10 tenths out of the RB19, but Checo is not. The reason why they won the championship so handily is really because the engineers have done a lot of the work here. And building them a car that has the potential to beat every other car on the grid on 95% of the tracks. But if you imagine yourself in a situation where the cars are far more equal, suddenly it's two teammates against one or one and a half. And you can't win championships like that. So, yes, there are going to be some teething issues and some problems with where George is in the team right now. But all told, I would want George in the team. He is the one that I want for a Constructors' Championship. There is a question to be had about what is the best strategy for a Drivers' Championship. I'm sure Peter Windsor would say, and Cameron would say, that George is the exact wrong person to have in the team for Lewis to win as many championships as possible. And that may be. But beating a teammate that's very challenging is more satisfying to me. So I would rather take that challenge on if I were Lewis, and no one could ever argue you had weak teammates to achieve your results.
Yeah, I think I'd rather have a George Russell on my team than rather not have a George Russell in my team. So yeah, completely agree with you there.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Back to the race in Suzuka. The team, as in Mercedes team, asked Lewis to give DRS to Russell after George let him through. We've been asked on Twitter, what do you think of the choice to give DRS to George? It doesn't seem like to be the best decision in that moment.
The human mind is such an interesting thing because it's very clear that decision was born of recency bias and what happened in the most recent race in Singapore, where Carlos Sainz very artfully gave Lando Norris DRS and allowed him to keep his position there, and by the same token, protect his own position. And the thought was, hey, we just saw someone do that. Maybe we can also try it at a completely different track with a completely different balance of power in the cars. And at the end of the day, that really wasn't ever going to work, not only because of the relative strengths of the Mercedes and the Ferrari at this particular track, but also because George had committed himself to a one-stop and everyone else around him was on a two-stop. So no matter how that was going to be, you know, how we cut that cake, so to speak, George was always going to be slow. Now, to be clear, Lewis did slow quite a bit. I mean, 2 seconds, 3 seconds, I don't remember what it was, but he slowed down significantly precisely to be able to give George DRS and allow him to keep DRS. But if you go back and look at the moment when Carlos Sainz passes him, they both have DRS. George has DRS and Sainz has DRS. So at the end of the day, you know, Lewis giving George DRS didn't prevent the outcome that they were trying to avoid. And if anything, exposed Lewis to an increased vulnerability to Sainz towards the end of the race, which he fought off very impressively. But more importantly, he had no chance whatsoever of catching Leclerc after the fighting that the George and Lewis did, and also slowing Lewis down to give George DRS. Leclerc was gone. He was in the wind. So it effectively sealed the order as it was as it finished. I think that was the wrong decision. But again, I have, you know, 2020 hindsight. I'm sure the team is trying to do everything they can in the moment to make the right decision. One thing we cannot do is make a decision based on someone else's emotions. If someone's going to be mad that you make the decision and that's the reason why you didn't make it, that's the wrong decision. You should make the decision based on what are the fastest cars in the situation? What is the best opportunity for the team to maximize its point score? That has to be the only thing. It really can't matter if one of the drivers is upset.
Where do you think, if we took emotion out of it then, Bryson, where do you think George and Lewis could have come in Japan?
I think George was always going to be passed by Sainz, primarily because of the one-stop versus two-stop, you know, strategy difference. The degradation was just too high. So it's good to get away with a one-stop. But I do think Lewis could have had a chance at overtaking Leclerc. You know, Suzuka is such a brilliant circuit. You know, we think of it as this incredible driver circuit with the S's and then Dunlop and then Degner 1, Degner 2, and Hairpin, you know, Spoon, you know, 130R. These are fantastic driver's corners. But actually, in certain situations with this current regulation of car, you can get some side-by-side turning in action into turn 1, even turn 2. It's hairy. It's very dangerous and high speed if you were to have a collision there, you know, Senna, Prost, I'm sure. But you can overtake in Suzuka, and you can overtake around the outside. So I think that if Lewis did have a chance where he was actually able to avoid the fighting with George and avoid the entanglement with the DRS question, and he was able to catch up to Leclerc, I mean, yeah, I think he had a realistic shot of passing him. Lewis was on fire in the race. I know Lewis has been self-critical of his qualifying performances both this year and last year, but you can't impugn his race pace. I mean, Lewis Hamilton on the hunt is a sight to behold.
It's blistering. I think that's the word I heard in commentary. His race pace was absolutely blistering. So Hontari on Twitter asked, McLaren can predict tracks. They will be strong. Red Bull can predict where Ferrari and McLaren will be strong. Why does Mercedes seem to still be in the fog about the W14 strengths? Does it have any? And at this point in the season, isn't that a bit concerning?
Does it have any? It was one of my favorite lines of that. Sort of, you can hear the existential dread creeping in. You know, what does it have? No, I mean, I think that's probably a little bit overstating things. I think Mercedes does more generally know when their car will be good. It'll be more competitive at high downforce circuits and at front limited circuits, but also circuits that don't have a huge number of straights. That's really been where Mercedes has been strongest. You know, Singapore, you know, Zandvoort, Hungary, to an extent. I mean, they know where they're going to be competitive. And Japan wasn't always going to be the most competitive circuit just because the second half is just so many straights. And also, they were having some tire warm-up issues and overall downforce levels weren't really as competitive as others. But one of the things that should be highlighted based on this comment is the ability for some teams to show up on a weekend and have just nail the setup right away, have the perfect setup from FP1, know exactly where the car needs to be and exactly how to set it up to maximize the performance from it. That is something that is a testament of, or is a testament to the performance and simulation work that the team does back at the factory before they ever get to the circuit. The simulator drivers, the simulator engineers, figuring out exactly how to set up their car, how to tune a digital twin, you know, in the computer world, and manifest that in an actual car in FP1 right away. Because the sooner you get your car locked in for dialed in for performance, the more time you have to work on strategy, more time you have to further improve performance. It just sets you ahead for the entire weekend. And this is something that Mercedes has not been good at historically over the current season. They've had FP1 sessions and FP2 sessions. Will show up and just have no clue where the setup is, where the right position is. And we rely once again on these, you know, Friday night miracles that Mick Schumacher is helping with. And they find a lot of pace on Saturday and even more pace on Sunday. That's a very admirable and positive talent that they have to be able to make those turnarounds on Friday night, but it shouldn't be necessary. And then in the time in the future, there will be a time in the future. I can't tell you exactly when. There will be a time Mercedes has been able to build a car that is just as competitive as a Red Bull. And in that moment, the differentiator between winning and losing is going to come down to operational skill. It's going to come down to pit stops, strategy, nailing the setup on day one. All of these things are going to be critical, whereas right now they're just an inconvenience.
So why, I think that question is why is that then? We see Red Bull and Max turning up to pretty much every race, bar Singapore, obviously, and just absolutely blowing everyone out of the water. So why is that such a problem for Mercedes? Is that down to, oh no, we have some personnel change with James Allison and Mike Elliott in the middle of the season? Is it down to that? Is there any other reasons of why they cannot hit the ground running as soon as they land in a country?
I mean, I think Mercedes has some of the most talented engineers in the world. They have in the past, and I think they still do. I think if there is an issue, it comes down to a fundamental lack of understanding of their car. But let's remember, the car that we are seeing on track today isn't really the W14. It's the W14 and a half that was modified to not be a W14, the W13, to take a more Red Bull style approach to their side pod design and other issues with the floor. And I think people don't appreciate how much of an impact that legacy has on the current car. The fingerprints of the zero pod design, the fingerprints of that entire strategy of building a race car are currently in the car they currently have. And so the ability to understand that car, which is essentially Frankenstein's monster, is a tough challenge. But one of the reasons Red Bull might be able to actually understand their car better than Mercedes is because they haven't had to reinvent it halfway through the season. They know what their car is, what its strengths are, what its weaknesses are, and they aren't learning in real time. I think that might be the best reason. So I'm not going to criticize the skill or talent or dedication of the engineers, or fine people working at Brackley. It just might be a fundamental understanding of this specific car and why they're racing this specific car is a function of the legacy that they had previously and other constraints like the cost cap and other factors.
So the race finished with Lewis Hamilton at P5 and George Russell with P7. And Erwin on Twitter asks, is it realistic to think Hamilton and Mercedes would mount a charge for P2 in the WDC?
Yes, definitely. You know, there's an old saying that there's a limit to how good your good days can be, but there's really no limit to how bad your bad days can be, you know? And the problem that Sergio Perez is currently facing is his good days are very good. He can finish second or in a race and win one on occasion. But the problem is on his bad day, he's not finishing fifth, he's finishing 15th or not finishing the race at all. And that is a situation that Mercedes largely has been able to avoid. Yes, there's some internal friction between George and Lewis, but they are a very strong team and they're taking points off of other people that would otherwise be a factor. And Lewis has had a resurgence of sorts in his race performances. He's been lucky to avoid some crashes and now, there's a discussion to be had there, but his race pace has been phenomenal. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if Lewis was able to get second in the driver's championship. I hate to think what that would mean for Sergio Perez and his relationship with Red Bull, but it's certainly something that Lewis can do as a team, as Mercedes as a team themselves. You know, they're going to be under pressure. I mean, yes, they currently, you know, are second in the Constructors' Championship, but Ferrari has found some real pace. McLaren is suddenly there. One of the things that Ferrari found, this started in Monza, but has dividends for the rest of the season. They actually found that part of their tire degradation problem wasn't the lack of downforce. It was actually the way in which the hybrid system was deploying energy. It was deploying it in a way that was accelerating rear tire wear, either at too low a speed or too aggressively or some combination of all these things. And by reworking the electronics and the logic of their hybrid system, they've actually been able to improve tire wear considerably. It's nowhere near Red Bull level, but they're better. And we should expect them to be more of a threat at the tracks going forward. And McLaren is all the evidence you need that the engine is not the problem. The chassis is a problem, and there's much, much more lap time to find. So I think that Mercedes can get second in the Constructors' Championship. I think Lewis has a real shot at second in the Drivers' Championship, but it's going to be a fight.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
So just to finish this podcast, we've got a few more questions, Bryson, from Twitter. So Hamza is saying, Lewis mentioned that adding downforce to the car brings back bouncing and the porpoising. So do you think this is why our upgrades have not fully worked compared to the McLarens? Are we still fundamentally limited by the zero pod concept? And if so, what performance gains should we expect with a W15 next year?
Yeah, I think one of the questions about adding downforce and the rule changes that were made for this current year, you know, modifying the floor edge height and changing the way the diffuser works was intended to sort of, you know, get us further away from porpoising. These types of cars and the nature of their ground effect floors means you're never going to be totally free of porpoising. The question is, what is the margin to it? You know, how close can you get to it without it being a huge problem that will, you know, cause back injuries and things like this? So it's definitely possible to have porpoising again. And I think that one of the ways that Red Bull was able to mitigate this factor was not just their, you know, brilliant suspension design and, you know, side pod design and three-dimensional features in the floor itself, but also having a higher roof to the floor, if that makes sense. You know, if you're trying to maximize downforce in principle, you want to make the smallest possible gap, you know, between the airflow and the floor for the floor and the ground to have the minimum cross-sectional area, maximum velocity, lowest pressure. Sounds great in theory, but when you have something that has a very, very small running clearance, minute changes in ride height or just the flexibility of the floor can put you in a situation where the floor will stall, separate, the car will jump up, and then it will come back down again, and you can have this porpoising issue. If you make the roof of the floor a little bit higher, that might not give you the immediate peak downforce that you are theoretically capable of getting, but it will allow you to run the car lower to the ground overall. And if you can make up for that loss from downforce by
exploiting vortices and using some advanced aerodynamic techniques, you can overall have a net gain versus having a more simplified floor that has a lower roof, if that makes sense. And so the question of, is this car still fundamentally compromised by the legacy of the ZeroPod? I mean, the answer to that is certainly yes. One of the things that we haven't even talked about, we've talked a lot about side impact structures and where they are because of ZeroPod, and that's certainly a thing. It affects driver position and so many other factors. But something we haven't even talked about is the gearbox casing and the gearbox design. I mean, the design of the gearbox currently, it affects how tall the diffuser can be. It affects the rear suspension pickup points. I mean, it would be fantastic if Mercedes could have a totally new gearbox casing that would allow them to have a different suspension. It would give them an entirely new real estate to be able to actually design the diffuser in the floor exactly like Red Bull, but they physically can't. And this is also one of the limitations that Aston Martin and McLaren have. Even if they saw the Red Bull floor in Monaco, which they did, they couldn't bring an exact replica of that floor because it's physically, mechanically constrained by the design of the gearbox. And so that's another thing that isn't explicitly ZeroPod, but it's a limitation that they can't change mid-season, even if they want to, because of cost cap and the number of gearboxes you can have in a given season. So, you know, changing horses mid-race is always going to compromise your performance. The W14 is in many senses a compromised machine, but the benefit of the W15 is that it's going to be a completely clean sheet design. If you're asking what do Mercedes fans have to look forward to in the future, is that the humbling experience that Mercedes has gone through in 2022 and in 2023 has completely destroyed any notions of holding on to previously cherished concepts and allowing them to impact the car design. They're going in a completely different direction. I'm sure Lewis is giving his own input on things that can improve. I promise you, he's not just saying to them, make the car faster. I mean, his feedback is more granular than that. He can give them more information. But fundamentally, yes, there's going to be a more Red Bull-style car that will be developed, not only by Mercedes, but also by Ferrari next year. I know some people are annoyed by this or depressed that the Red Bull design is the best design and that others are going in that same direction. But you have to remember, at the end of the day, it's the same physics for everyone. Right. I mean, yes, there's going to be some variability still, but it shouldn't be a surprise that we're ending up in a similar area of the design space.
And we've got new regulations coming in 2026, which would be super, super interesting to see how they make their car. And also, Bryson, my new favorite phrase is changing horses mid-race. So if that's okay with you, Bryson, I'm stealing that and adding it to my vocabulary. Hey,
I stole it. I stole it from someone else. Don't feel bad at all.
Hopefully someone can steal it for me. Cliff is asking, there are rumors of Mercedes introducing a new floor at Circuit of the Americas. Have you heard anything? And if so, what kind of gains are they looking at? This, again, we're going into rumor mill at the moment, but what, have you heard anything, Bryson, in terms of a new floor in Austin?
So not only have I heard this from news sources, reputable sources like Amos and others, but I've also heard this from sources inside the team that shall remain unnamed. So there is definitely a floor coming. What's unclear exactly is what's coming, because there certainly is going to be a shift in philosophy. I mentioned previously that Red Bull gave us the benefit of allowing us to see their floor in Monaco. And it takes time for engineers to pore over thousands of high resolution photos of a floor and gain some engineering knowledge from that, then apply that to a design they're currently working on, and then actually push that through the pipeline and have it come out the other side as a developed part for an upgrade. Not only is the fact that that process inherently is slow, but a floor is a massive construction of carbon. It's a big single piece. Takes a long time to manufacture. And these floors are also instrumented with sensors and pitot tubes and all kinds of complicated things that just gives it a long lead time to be able to create a new upgrade. So if there were any learnings from the crashed RB19 we saw in Monaco, they're going to start to be making their presence known in the next coming races. I think AlphaTauri may already be there. I think AlphaTauri gave us an unintentional great look at their floor, thanks to our good friend Ted Kravitz on the notebook. He actually felt kind of bad about showing it to us. But I think several teams are going to be able to make some floor changes. And one of the benefits of 2024 is that the regulations, as I currently understand them, are not going to change radically for 2024. I mean, there will be some tweaks, I'm sure. But ultimately, a lot of the learnings that teams have and they find in this year will apply to next year's car. But you might say, wait a second, didn't we say that in 2022 about the 2023 car? Why didn't that result in an all-conquering W14? And the short answer is Mercedes changed car concepts mid-season. Even if it were possible to make the car that they were developing, the learnings that they had from 2022 and apply them to a new car, those don't actually apply to a car that has a totally different side pod concept, totally different ride height philosophy. You know, this is the cost of changing horses mid-race, as you mentioned, but it's a necessary step. They had to do it because they'd be even slower if they didn't. So the short answer is there are things coming in Austin. I can't tell you numerically how much they're worth. I always am amused by people who say, well, can't you tell us exactly how much it's worth? I mean, no. I mean, I don't work for the team. And I would be lying to you if I looked at a guide vane or a strake on a car and said, that is worth 2/10 for sure. I mean, that's just a lie. If you want me to lie to you, I suppose I can, but I probably won't.
My next question was going to be to you, Bryson, how much is it worth? But I won't do that. And I think this is a perfect time to end. So, Bryson, as always, thank you so much for coming onto the Silver Arrows podcast.
Hey, glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
That's all we have time for this week. A massive thank you to Bryson for joining us. His social media handles are in the show notes. And thanks to you for listening. Do remember to follow us on Twitter at MercF1Pod and hit that follow button in your podcast app. If you're enjoying these episodes and feeling extra kind, drop us a review and share this episode with anybody who you think may enjoy it. We'll see you soon.